Okay, kids, you're in for a real treat today. These gentlemen have kindly volunteered to demonstrate how a stun gun is used to subdue a suspect.
Ooh. That's right.
Wait a second. What?
Now, there's two ways to use a stun gun.
Up close and personal.
Really or,
oh, fuck.
You can shoot it from a distance. Now, do I have any volunteers who want to come up here and do some shooting, huh? All right, how about you, young lady? Come on up here.
Hello, and welcome to The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. My guest on this week's show is the hilarious Rob Riggle. Rob has such a fascinating story, from starting out in the Marines at 19 years old to eventually joining SNL for a season and then going on to The Daily Show. You also know him from films like Step Brothers and The Hangover and so many other great parts. And now he is hosting a mini-golf competition show called Holy Moly on ABC. Rob can be kind of an intimidating presence on screen, but he really could not have been sweeter in person, so I'm really excited for everyone to hear this interview. Before we get to that, I want to remind you again to please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know who your favorite guest on the show has been so far, who you want to see on the show. One recent commenter suggested Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and I am keeping my fingers crossed that that just might happen in the near future. But for now, let's listen to me and Rob Riggle. So where are you coming from today?
Oh gosh, I did Access Live and The Talk.
Oh wow, how's The Talk? Seems like that would be intense.
It's always intense, you know. They actually were very gracious, very kind, and it was simple. It's softball stuff. We weren't talking politics.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah. So thank goodness, because no one can win when you talk politics.
Yeah. Congrats on Holy Moly.
Thank you.
I saw that the premiere got something like 10 million viewers over all the different platforms. That's like some Game of Thrones shit.
Yeah. I don't know if it's Game of Thrones level, but it did very well. And I'm very happy about that.
Were you surprised? I mean, it seems like it kind of, I didn't know what to expect from the show, and it seems like people are really digging it.
Yeah, you know, it's not, I don't know if it's so much being surprised as it is, I'm just really glad, because you never know how these things go. You know, I've made movies where you're like, oh, this is going to be amazing, or you make movies and you're like, I think it's funny, but I have no idea.
Yeah.
And then it turns out to be The Hangover, or, you know, and it goes off the charts, and so you're like, wow, I guess it just struck with people. And the same thing with this. You know, we had fun doing it, but you never know if people are going to embrace it or not. And they did, thank goodness.
Yeah. So can you kind of talk about how this show came to be? I know Steph Curry was part of the origin story of it. So how did you get involved in it?
I don't know. They asked me.
Yeah.
It's real simple. It's, you know, it's not like it was, I wish there was some sexy backstory. I had met Steph a couple times when I hosted the ESPYs. Mm-hmm. I had met him. Up at the Tahoe golf tournament, I'd met him a couple times on the putting green.
Yeah, you guys are both big golfers, yeah.
Yeah, and so we kind of knew of each other that way. And then when they reached out to me to do the show, you know, I'm a working comedian and actor, mm-hmm. so, you know, of course I'm like, yeah, tell me, I love golf, tell me more, it sounds fun. And so when they described what was going on, I said, yeah, let's do it. So that's basically how it came about.
Yeah. I love how much you guys kind of acknowledge the absurdity of it up top. Just, you know, the idea of this, taking this seriously.
I think you have to.
Golf tournament.
Yeah, you have to. You know, anybody, if you try to, it's the only way to play it is to have fun with it.
It's all about focus on the distractor.
Take everything you knew about golf etiquette and throw it out the window. Uh-oh. What is that sound?
It is none other than Grammy Award winner Kenny G.
Holy moly! Look at this!
The sweet stylings of Kenny G in the face of Holly Fine.
A master of distraction and a master of outstanding saxophone music. Sometimes I'll be driving around the road and I'll think of Kenny G and drive into a ditch.
Yeah, was that kind of how does it work in terms of the commentary? Because it seems like it's a lot of it's has to be improvised in the moment because you're kind of reacting to this real stuff. So was that an appeal for you too to kind of be able to improvise in that way?
Yeah, I think so. I think I came up through improv at the UCB Theater in New York, and I still do it out here in LA at the UCB Theater. So improv and sketch and eventually I started doing stand up, but improv's always been the first love. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I love those kind of situations where you can crack wise, mm-hmm. if you will, on things like that. So it definitely appealed to me to have that element of the show. It was like that on The Daily Show too, when you were doing an interview in the field. There are no writers around, you know. You just have to make, you know, if you get a crazy answer, you got to make something out of that, or you know, you've got to make something happen in those interviews, in those moments. I'm talking about the field pieces. You know, the set pieces back in the studio were different, but I think it's definitely a fun skill to dust off every now and then. It's like a muscle; you got to exercise it.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of Daily Show people on this show so far, including Jenna Friedman, who is a field producer. Mm-hmm. And Jordan Klepper and Samantha Bee, and just talking about how those field pieces really do feel like the ultimate improv exercises in some ways, because you're doing improv with someone who's kind of a willing participant, kind of doesn't know they're in an improv scene always.
They definitely don't know they're in an improv scene. They're there to tell you a story.
Yeah.
And usually they're there to tell you their story, and they're not listening to you. And that's why you get away with so much, is because they're on transmit more than they're on receive.
Yeah. So I definitely want to talk about The Daily Show later, but I also wanted to ask you about the Shark Week special that you have coming up, because I saw the promo for that. That looks like a lot of fun. What can people expect from that show?
Yeah, last year I got to co-host it with Shaq, mm-hmm. and we had a blast. And this year they asked me to come back and host it and bring some friends, so mm-hmm. I did. So I brought Damon Wayans Jr., Joel McHale, Adam Devine, and Anthony Anderson.
Yeah.
All people that I've worked with on some level. Mm-hmm. And like Damon and I have done a couple movies together, and the rest of us have done comedy. Adam Devine and I used to tour together doing stand-up.
Oh, yeah.
Way back in the day. And anyway, it was fun to get everybody back together and kind of hang. And so I took them down to the Bahamas, and we went swimming with sharks. We went scuba diving with sharks. We went out in the open water. We did it in tanks. We had multiple exposures to multiple sharks, and it's for real.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
how protected are you? I mean,
you're not. I'm in a wetsuit. There's no chain mail on us or anything. There was there was one set of chain mail, mm-hmm. But the guy who was handling the bait box, mm-hmm. the chum box on the bottom of the ocean floor, we let him wear it because the sharks were coming by and he had it in his hands and stuff. But we were, at one point we were surrounded by like 20 sharks.
Yeah.
And because they came in for the feeding, and it's intense. Your heart's racing and your head's on a swivel, and you can tell, like, sometimes they're looking at you and they're checking you out, and then they move on, and but then they circle back. And so somebody's we're in the,
Nope.
Oh, I guess that's.
I guess that's not.
Yeah. Someone's knocking on the door. It must be outside.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it was very intense, and it was cool because it was also kind of a bonding experience. Because as soon as we'd get out of the water and we'd get back on the boat, you're like kids again. You're like, mm-hmm. oh my God, did you see that one? And oh, that one swam right between your legs, and da da da. And it was just a very cool experience.
Yeah, I mean, with a bunch of comedians, it seems like there must be some pressure to be funny in that situation. But is it hard to be funny when you're surrounded by sharks?
No, that's the thing. Like, I think that's how comedians deal with stress
and
anxiety, is they make fun of it, mm-hmm. and they try to make jokes about it. And so, and also when you get a bunch of comedians in the room, they're going to start cracking jokes and doing bits and stuff, which is what you hope for. Mm-hmm. And that's what we were hoping for. Yeah. So
did any of those guys handle it better or worse than others, the sharks?
Everybody was pretty good. I think Anthony, screamed the most, but I think he was playing it for laughs too.
Yeah.
So,
any stories that you can share maybe that aren't going to make the final cut? From your day out there with the sharks?
I mean, no. We it was so funny that we'd get like at one point I had a big old fish head on a rope, mm-hmm. and I was chumming the waters, the shallows, and this beach in Exuma, which is this remote, you know, abandoned island, mm-hmm. and we're chumming, and I would let the and I was trying to get the sharks in closer to shore, and they would see the fish head, the chum, and they would come at it, and then I'd reel the rope in, and then bring them in closer, mm-hmm. and then I'd throw it back out, and that's how we kept the sharks close.
Yeah.
And then I threw it out one time, and I let a shark get a hold of it.
Yeah.
And you can have a little tug of war. It's mm-hmm. like a, it's like a dog with a bone, you know, you're having a tug of war. And I let too much slack get in the rope.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he, because normally if you keep it taut, you got it. It's not a problem. Yeah. But when I let too much slack, he turned and got a running start. And yeah. pulled that rope right through my hand. Oof. And I can, you can still see the cut right yeah. there. And it went all the way around because it was around my hand, and it just went zzz, and it ripped my hand. And, you Oof. Know, so that was starting to bleed. And then I was like, I don't want to be in the water with a bloody hand.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good.
And then he got the, you know, I let go of the rope because it was burning.
Yeah.
And so he swam off with the fish head and the rope, and we never saw him again. But I don't know. Maybe that made I don't know if the cameras were rolling or not on that one.
Yeah. So what'd you do about the bloody hand?
Nothing. I put some Band-Aids on it, and we kept going.
So I want to kind of go back a little bit and talk a little bit about your story and kind of how you got to where you are. So you you joined the Marines at 20 years old.
Yeah, 19.
19. Mm-hmm. So how did you make that decision at that time? And at that time, was comedy something that was even kind of on your mind, on your radar?
Absolutely. Yeah. I was a huge comedy fan growing up. I mean, I was a child of the 80s. So Stripes, Caddyshack, Ghostbusters, whatever else, you mm-hmm. know, any comedy I soaked up, yeah. just soaked it up. Mm-hmm. And in high school, you know, I played a lot of sports, but I was in forensics is what it was called back in Kansas.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
called forensics. And it's like theater, but it's theater competition. Hmm. So you would sign up and you'd go for a weekend and, you know, I'm going to be in IDAs, improvised duet acting.
Oh, wow.
Or I'd be in...
it's like theater sports, like in right. it's Chicago, like, right?
Well, but that's more improv, like games, improv yeah. games. But this was like... So you'd sign up for like three or four events in a weekend. And so IDA and DA, which was like duet acting. So you'd actually get scenes and prepare a scene. And, you know, I loved that stuff, you know,
yeah.
Because I didn't have to do necessarily whole productions. And I could still go for a weekend and do these competitions. And I could still play sports and I could still do, you know, like it just was a nice mix. And so I had a passion for it, but I didn't have the guts for it.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got to Kansas University, which is where I went to undergrad, I was a theater and film major there. And I liked to focus on film. I enjoyed
yeah.
studying film, and I thought I was going to be a filmmaker. And I enjoyed the acting, but again, I just didn't think to me it was such a pipe dream. It was like, well, only certain people are actors, and it's mm-hmm. you're never going to get paid, and da 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 da. Well, while I was doing that, I also got my pilot's license. So I had my pilot's license.
Just because that was something you were interested in? Or?
Well, it did interest me. And I was fortunate enough, my grandfather, I think, was living vicariously through me.
Mm-hmm.
and he offered to pay for my pilot's license. Mm. So I said, okay. I wasn't going to say no to it. So I said, okay. And I went and did that. And then... I guess some recruiter heard about me, you know, with my pilot's license and said, listen, we offer a guaranteed flight contract so you can join the Marines and become a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all you got to do is take this test. And if you score high enough, we can get you the contract. And then, of course, you got to do all the other stuff. You got to actually go through boot camp
yeah.
and you got to go through officer candidate school and you got to go through the basic school and you got to do all this stuff. But you'll get to flight school and you can be Top Gun or whatever. Well, you know.
Is that what you had in your head? Is
well,
the, what,
of course.
What it was going to be like?
Yeah, I mean, I've made this joke 1,000 times, but, you know, I was looking at two choices, Top Gun or waiter, Top Gun or waiter. you know, into a 22-year-old kid, you know, I'll take Top Gun. Yeah.
Had you seen Cocktail at that point? Maybe that was
of course. I'd seen them all. I'd seen them all.
That could be it, yeah.
So anyway, so that's what I did. I joined when I was 19. I finished my undergrad. I went through officer candidate school while I was an undergrad. When I graduated from college, I accepted my commission as a second lieutenant. I went to the basic school. Then I went down to Pensacola, started flight school there. Then I went to Corpus Christi, continued on flight school there. Got, I think I got helicopters out of primary and intermediates, which is if you line up 7 out of 10, if you line up 10 pilots, 7 in the Marine Corps, 7 of them are going to be helicopter pilots.
Just because there's more space for
that's
that?
That's because that's what we do.
Yeah.
That's the workhorse, the helicopter fleet. We have Cobras, we have CH-53s, we have CH-46s, we have Hueys. We have this whole helicopter fleet because that's what we're infantry, you know, at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And then we have 2 out of the 10 pilots would be jet pilots. Mm-hmm. They fly F-18s and Harriers. And then 1 out of the 10 would be C-130 pilot, transport, cargo, that kind of stuff. So I finished primary and intermediate in Corpus, and I got this. Well, at that same time, someone reached out to me, a friend of mine from college who had moved up to Chicago and was studying at Second City and Improv Olympic. And he called me and was like, dude, Riggle, I'm telling you, what we did in college, it's called improv. It has a name, and you would do really well up here.
People are doing it.
Yeah, people do it. And he goes, and you would do really, really, you're better than half the people up here. I'm telling you, you should come up and do this. And I'm like, Kevin, his name was Kevin. Yeah. I was like, Kevin, I'm in flight school in the Marine Corps right now. I've signed a contract, you know, like this is it. And he's like, I'm telling you, dude, you need to think about this. So I did. Because, you know, it was a passion of mine, and flying was fine. I was fine.
Yeah.
But you need to be passionate about what you do.
Yeah.
And especially if you're flying off a ship at night over some ocean, and you got, you know, 15 Marines in the back of your helicopter, you got to love what you're doing.
Yeah. The stakes are a little higher than improv.
Yeah. And so I did. I did some real soul searching, and it was my first big decision in my life. I call it my quarter life crisis. Mm-hmm. I think I was 24 at the time. And I had to make a decision. Was I going to continue to pursue flying, or was I going to stop before? Because once I got my wings, once you pin your wings on, that's when it's over. Because then they got you.
Yeah.
And you owe them 8 years from that moment forward. So it takes 2.5 years to get there.
Yeah.
And then 8 years after that. So I was like, oh, God, you know, if I pin those wings on, I'm in for almost 11 years. And then I'd only have 9 years to retirement. I'd be a senior captain or a junior major at that point. So yeah. I'd be foolish to get out if I only had 9 more years. So all of a sudden I was like, dang, I'm looking at 20 years
that's
in
your
a blink
life.
Of an eye. Yeah. And I was like, oh, goodness. So I made my first grown-up decision. Well, my second one. My first one was to join. Mm-hmm. My second one was to stop flying.
Yeah.
So I did. And I stopped flying, and I transitioned over to the ground side, which made my contract go down. Mm-hmm. In matter of length. And I was fine with that. I wasn't trying to skate out. I wasn't trying to get out of anything. Yeah. But I didn't want to do 20 years, which was kind of what I was looking at. Or at least I didn't want to do 11 years even before I even had the choice.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, okay, I'm going to switch to the ground side. And that's what I did. I quit flying. I switched over to the ground side, became a ground officer, went to Defense Information School. They made me a public affairs officer. So then from there, I went from DINFOS, is what it's called, Defense Information School. I went from DINFOS to the fleet, joined 2nd Marine Air Wing out in Cherry Point. While stationed there, I was the deputy public affairs officer for 2nd Marine Air Wing and went to night school. You know, there's not much to do in Eastern North Carolina except get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So I just went to night school, kept myself out of trouble, and got a master's in public administration. And then when my time was up, after 3 years on station there, I was like, all right, thanks for the memories. I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. I'm going to Chicago. I'm going to study at Second City. And I'm going to give this thing a shot.
Yeah. So, I mean, even that was like 3 years where you kind of had to think about whether that was still what you wanted to do. And at the end of that 3 years, Second City was still what you wanted to do.
It was still the choice because, you know, I don't quit things very often, maybe never. Like that might have been the only thing I actually quit. Well, that and the bass guitar. I quit the bass guitar. I sucked. I suck at musical instruments. But yeah, those are the only two things I think I've ever quit, really. It didn't sit well with me. So I knew if I quit, I was going to try to make something happen.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to honor my obligation. I wasn't, like I said, I wasn't trying to skate out on anything or, you know. So I wanted to commit, you know, fulfill my commitment, which I did. And then I said, I'm moving. And the chief of staff for the 2nd Marine Air Wing, at the time I had been promoted to captain. And so he came in and was like, so what's going on, Captain Riggle? Why aren't you, why are you going?
Yeah.
You know, why are you leaving us, basically? And I didn't like telling everybody I was going to go try to be a comedian or whatever, because that'd be the same as me telling you right now, I'm quitting comedy to become a rapper.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of people would look at me.
Kind of ridicule.
Exactly. And people look at you like, okay, good luck with that, you know? And so I just didn't want anybody. People's judgments suck and I get tired of it. So I just don't engage people with that. So I told him, you know, I'm moving to Chicago, pursuing other things. You know, I just left it vague or whatever. And he was like, well, listen, you know, what would it take for you to stay in? And I said, well, because, you know, my plan was to move to Chicago and wait tables or bartend and do improv at night. And I thought about it for a night and I was like, you know, if I moved to L.A. or New York, because we have offices there, you know, I could still be a captain, get captain pay, you know, and still do comedy at night.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, no reason, nothing would stop me. So I said, if you can get me to New York or Los Angeles, I would, and I'll give you 3 more years. I'll extend. I won't augment, but I'll extend.
Yeah.
Next morning, he called my bluff, gave me orders to New York City.
Wow.
So I was like, all right, I'm in. So here we go. So I moved to New York. I moved into an apartment, sight unseen. It was a little 350 square foot studio apartment. It was big enough for my bed and my couch and a TV and a coffee table. But the coffee table had to be moved almost by the, I had to lean it up on the door to pull out the couch.
Yeah.
But I did have a bed and a bathroom and a little sink. And it was ridiculous. And it was it was like crazy money at the time, too, you know, because it was in Manhattan. And I moved up there, and that's it. I started, I got to New York, and I started working at the Marine office, you know, 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day. And then I was like, okay, well, let's figure this out. You came here to do comedy. Where do we begin? And I found a stand-up club on the Upper East Side called the Comic Strip Live. And there was a guy there, I'm going to screw up his name, J.B. or J.D. Sweeney, something like that. And he would teach classes.
And these were stand-up classes?
Yeah, stand-up classes. Because, I mean, I'm talking, I'm starting at zero.
You don't know what UCB is at this point.
They weren't there.
No, they weren't there yet.
Well, they might have been there. They might have just gotten
just started,
there. And so I go in, and I don't know where to begin. I'm just guessing here. So I went in, and I said, I'm here to learn comedy, you know, here to try. Sir, sign up. Give me your money. Here, we're going to meet every, you know, Monday at this time and write out your material. So I'm like, I don't know what to write. And so I don't even know how to craft a joke. I don't know how to. And I came up loving Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy and Bill Cosby, they were the best storytellers. I liked their comedy because it was a story. It wasn't...
Punchlines.
It wasn't it wasn't 3 jokes per minute, set up punch, set up punch, set up punch. And they took you on this wonderful journey. They did voices. They did characters. They did, you know, they really painted a picture. And I just thought that was the way stand-up should be. So I get in there and... He's going, what do you got? What do you got? And I'm like, oh, something about dog shit, you know? And he's like, okay, whatever. And I was like, well, it's funnier when if I tell the story, you know? And he's like, well, try it. So then I tried. It didn't work.
Still not funny.
Still not funny. And he's like, here's what we do. We do 3 jokes per minute.
Yeah.
Set up punch, set up punch, set up punch. And I was like, I don't even understand what that means. I don't even know. So I struggled all through the class.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm not an idiot, so I can try, you know, I can try. So I was trying, but I hated what I was doing. It was like an uncomfortable shirt. And then came show night, you know, the big show mm-hmm. night where you get to get up on stage and do 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, they expect you to bring people. Well, fuck that. I'm not bringing anybody.
Bring all your Marine buddies.
Exactly. I'm not bringing anybody to see this train wreck. So I was like, oh, sure, sure. Well, I didn't bring anybody. But I went up there and my adrenaline was going so hard. I could feel the pulse in my neck. It was just, And I'm not being dramatic. I'm not mm-hmm. melodramatic. I was getting not lightheaded, but there was a buzz in my head and I couldn't feel my fingertips. It was just like this adrenaline rush of a massive proportion. It was like a car wreck type mm-hmm. adrenaline rush. And they called my name, and I was so. I remember walking up on stage and trying to be confident, but not feeling it, and then. I remember saying some things and maybe getting a laugh and maybe not, but I didn't care because I didn't even care beyond 2 feet in front of my face. And thank God they videotape. Yes, this is how long ago it was. They videotape your set. Yeah. And then when you leave, you get the videotape. Mm-hmm. Or, you know. So I walked off the stage and I thought that was the worst experience I ever had. It was so bad. And I hated it, and I thought I made the biggest mistake of my life.
Yeah.
I really did. I thought, why did I stop flying? You know, why mm-hmm. did I? I could have had this whole other
have this low adrenaline job, like flying and
like flying, flying Cobra helicopters. But I don't know. It's just something. It's a different type of vulnerability. Yeah. It's a different type of adrenaline.
Mm-hmm.
And so I walk off the stage. He gives me the tape. I go immediately leave and drink and mm-hmm. then go back to my apartment. And then I put the tape in and it wasn't that bad. Like I didn't do badly, you know?
Was it hard? Was that decision to watch it hard?
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's why I had the beers before I went home. And I watched it and I was like, oh, it wasn't as bad as I remember. Yeah. Like there's some laughs and mm-hmm. people are having fun. And I looked way more comfortable than I was. Mm-hmm. Like I was faking it beautifully.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that wasn't terrible. But I realized that was so draining and so painful and so scary and so vulnerable. I'd never been that way mm-hmm. before. And I thought, I can't do that again. I don't want to do that again. I hated it.
Mm.
And that's why I really was in despair because I thought I made a massive mistake.
Yeah.
And then a friend of mine who has a friend, like through three different friends, this friend said, you need to call this guy and talk to him because I think he might be able to give you some perspective or, you know. And I was like, okay, who is it? You know, and they're like, it's Dave Koechner.
Hmm.
And I was like, okay, I know. He's on SNL right now, isn't he? Yeah, yeah. But he just got let go.
Hmm.
But yes, that's who we're talking about. So I was like, oh, great, you know, let me talk to him. So Dave was gracious enough, because we're kind of from the same hometown. We're very mm-hmm. close. And so he was very gracious, and I got on the phone with him. And he was like, all right, talk to me. What are you doing? And I said, well, here's what I just did. And I didn't explain everything. He goes, okay, all right. Well, I've got some friends from Chicago who just moved out here last summer. And they are some of the best improvisers, I think, in America. They're bound to go do big things. You ought to go check out their Ass Cat show on Sunday night. So I said, oh, okay. He goes, when you get done, go up to Matt Walsh and tell him Dave Koechner sent you and ask him about classes. So I said, okay. And I said, all right, thanks, man. I really appreciate your time. And, you know, he was gracious and gave me some words of encouragement, which is always nice. And then that was it. So I went down. I had met a guy. I was playing rugby in New York because I didn't know anybody. When I moved to New York, I didn't know anybody. And so I walked around my neighborhood. I found my Gristiti's, my shop, mm-hmm. you know, for my supermarket. I found a laundromat, and I found a bar called Ship of Fools on the Upper East Side. And that was the rugby bar. But I was like, this is a great sports bar. This is where I'm going to watch games. and you know. And it turned out to be the rugby bar. So then the bartender asked me to play rugby. And I said, sure, I don't have any friends. And all of a sudden I had friends. So I grabbed one of the guys from the rugby team and I said, well, come with me. I'm going to go see this show down at, you know, down in this old black box theater. You know, it was at Solo Arts. Yeah. It was this condemned building. It was awful.
And that was UCB.
And that was UCB. And so I went down. And for those of you who don't know, the UCB at the time consisted of Matt Besser, Matt Walsh, Ian Roberts, and Amy Poehler. And with special guest friends, Horatio Sands, mm-hmm. who used to play with them in Chicago, and then all the writers for Conan, all the writers for mm-hmm. SNL. Yeah.
Adam McKay.
I mean, it was just a murderer's row of great comedy talent and improvisers. And so I went to their ASCAT show, and I was blown away. Yeah. I was like, they're making this up? This is just coming to them? And how are they playing so well together? And how do they know? Like, they're making great moves. They're hilarious. They're doing characters. They're doing everything. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is genius. I was so impressed with what I saw that I immediately went up to Walsh after the show. And I said, hi, I'm Rob Riggle. I'm friends with Dave Koechner. And he said I should come say hi to you. And Walsh goes, oh, yeah, Dave said you'd be coming by. Oh, and I was like, oh,
nice.
I was like, so, Dave's the best. And I was like, where do I sign up? And he goes, right here.
Yeah.
And he gave me the sheet. I signed up that night. I said, I want classes. And at the time, the only people teaching classes were the actual four Brett Sensenbury. So I wanted to learn from all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I took they only taught three levels, level one, two, and three.
Mm-hmm.
And I took all three levels twice.
So you could get a mix of the different,
I had Amy Poehler for a teacher. I had Ian Roberts. I had Walsh. Mm-hmm. I had Besser. And I had them all mix and match.
That's incredible.
So I had like Poehler for one and three.
Yeah.
And I had Ian Roberts for one and two. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you just kind of mix it. And I learned from some of the absolute mm-hmm. best. And I was so grateful to have that opportunity to study with them and learn from them. And then eventually I got put on a house team
mm-hmm.
and started doing shows with, Paul Scheer, Rob Hubel, Chad Carter, Owen Burke, Danielle, Schneider, Donna Fineglass, Jackie Clark, Jack McBrayer, you know, like mm-hmm. just this unbelievable group of wonderful improvisers, wonderful comedians. And we formed a team,
mm-hmm.
and we put on sketch shows. We were writing sketches all the time. We'd put on special sketch shows. We would do improv shows. We eventually got, you know, the Saturday Night Show with the Swarm, and you know so we had this wonderful run, you know, for 7 years before I got an opportunity to do SNL.
Coming up, Rob opens up about his one and only, quote, dysfunctional season at Saturday Night Live. Yeah, so I mean, SNL, I think you have a unique situation where SNL was kind of your first showbiz gig in some ways,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I literally was called back to active duty after 9/11. And so I got back at the end of 2002, right at the beginning of 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And was on SNL in 2004.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was rapid.
It's pretty wild.
Yeah. But I had been doing improv since 97. So mm-hmm. 97 to 2004, you know, I'm doing shows every weekend. I'm doing lights and tech for mm-hmm. other people's shows during the middle of the week.
So you had a lot of experience, but not necessarily TV. TV
experience. And I couldn't commit to too much either because I was in the Marines still. Yeah. You know, it's not
was
like
that
even,
not the case. So by 2004,
I was out.
You were out.
Well, I was out of active duty.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the reserves mm-hmm. at that point.
So you still can get.
I could still get called back. Yeah, which is what happened in 2001. I got called mm-hmm. back. I was in the reserves at that point because
mm-hmm.
I left active duty in 2000.
Yeah.
So
was that an issue? I mean, when you were auditioning for SNL, did they know that you were, you know, could be called away? Because they have pretty strict contracts at SNL, too.
They do have strict contracts at SNL. But I didn't tell them, and they didn't ask. So
they didn't think to ask that.
No,
probably.
That's probably something they haven't asked many of their people.
So I know there's kind of an interesting story about your audition. You auditioned with Rob Hubel at that time?
Or, not with him.
Or at the same time?
We were asked to audition not as a team,
mm-hmm.
but individually.
Yeah.
Now, Rob and I had done a two-man show together,
mm-hmm.
which we took to the Aspen Comedy Festival, and you know, it helped us get agents, mm-hmm. and you know, it was a great show, and it had a long run. It was called Kung Fu Grip, and I'm still very proud of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, we were not asked to audition together. It mm-hmm. was individually. Mm-hmm. So that's how it went down.
And what was that experience like for you? That audition? That must have been a big deal.
Yeah, it's you know, it's a dream of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I've been watching SNL since, God, when did I didn't really see the first group. I saw reruns mm-hmm. or whatever, but Eddie Murphy in 81, I remember seeing, mm-hmm. Especially with his James Brown Celebrity Hot Tub. You know, those are some of the classic sketches mm-hmm. of all time.
Yeah.
And Velvet Jones and just all these great characters he used to do. But anyway, Mr. Robinson's in the Neighborhood. I remember, you know, that was my first cast. Because here's the thing about SNL. SNL has, it's a, you know, you get new cast all the time, and every generation kind of has their cast, or not even generation, but, you know, I remember when I was in junior high, I watched it constantly. And then you watch a little bit in high school and you get away from it, maybe a little for a couple of years, and you check back in when they got a new cast when you're in college, and then your first couple of years out of college. And so there's always this, you're always looking at it going, who's this guy? You know, what? I don't even like his face. And then turns out, give him 2 years and you're like, I love this guy. Yeah. He's the best.
Well, that's what Will Ferrell always talks about, that people, you know, the reviews were like, he was the annoying new guy on SNL.
There you go. That's how it works. Cause you have a group of people that you trust. And then they introduce new people, and you're like, screw this guy. You know, why are they messing with it? You know, I like the, God. And then, of course, the first couple sketches they have you doing, you're not great in them. You know, and you don't get a lot of meat on the bone. You don't get a lot of jokes because they're saved for, you know, your A players or whatever. And so it's hard in the beginning. It's super hard.
Yeah. Did you feel comfortable there?
Nobody
ever.
Nobody does. Nobody does. I won't mention any names, but I talked to many senior cast members, many. And they said every year they assumed they were not coming back every single year. And one of the ladies, I was like, you've been on for 6 years. And she goes, yeah. She goes, but they hate me and they're trying to get rid of me. And I'm like, you've been on for 6 years. You're like, you're fine, you know? And other guys would be like, I just assume every year this is my last.
I mean,
wow, that's a tough way to go through.
Do you think they do that on purpose? I mean,
of course.
Just to kind of keep you hungry?
It's a very, listen, I don't want to bash on it because I'm always grateful that I got the dream come true to be on that show. So I'm not one to bash on it, but it is not, I wouldn't say it's not dysfunctional.
You wouldn't say it's not dysfunctional. I mean, you were there for one season.
Yeah.
Did you spend the whole season thinking you were not going to go beyond that, or what was your feeling?
Well, it was such a weird, I had a very special circumstance. So the year I was hired, I was the only guy hired.
Yeah. They kind of kept all the same cast and added you.
Exactly.
And
someone
left, right? Jimmy Fallon.
The
left,
cast
I think it was. Yeah.
The cast was massive. The cast was 14, and I made 15. So that's the biggest cast they've ever had.
Yeah.
And so I was this one guy. Well, normally, like I talked to Will Ferrell about it, and he's like, the year they hired me, they hired six of us.
Yeah. So at least you have someone in it with you.
Well, not only that, but and he goes, and there was only 12 on our cast. So we made up, the rookies made up half the cast. He goes, guess what? We got in every week.
Yeah.
We got our sketches on the air. We got, you know, we got our FaceTime. We got out because they didn't have any choice. Well, 15 people on the cast. I'm the only new guy. Well, you know, Daryl Hammond's getting his, Tina Fey, Amy's getting hers, Maya Rudolph's getting hers, Will Forte, go down the list. They're all getting their time. So the fact that I didn't know any of the writers hardly, I didn't, you know, I knew Amy, I knew some of these other folks, but I didn't know the bulk of these folks. I'm going in there and I'm drinking out of a fire. This is the first showbiz gig I ever got. So it's overwhelming to begin with. And
plus, it's like the most overwhelming showbiz gig.
Absolutely,
that you can get.
it's the unbelievable pace and pressure you know, I got to a point. I got to a point where I didn't even know what was funny anymore by the end of the season. But what happened was, it was an election year. This was explained to me by one of the producers, by the way. It was an election year.
2004. Right?
Yeah, it was Kerry Bush. And no one cared about that election.
Yeah.
Okay. So the ratings normally, Saturday Night Live gets this huge ratings bounce.
It's like the only election year that didn't get that, that bounce.
So it normally gets a big bounce, but this year it didn't. So all the executives at NBC panic. They all go, oh God, we didn't get our big bump. Oh no, that means something's flawed, something's wrong. It has nothing to do with the American people didn't care about that election. It just, whatever, something's wrong. So NBC decides to clear house. And last one in, first one out. I got swept up in that. So I I won't have a pity party, but I wish I would have had another season because yeah. I had much more confidence, I think, and mm-hmm. I would have been able to come in and be more myself yeah, because yeah. I tried to please 20 masters. Mm-hmm. And when you try to do that, you please no one. Mm-hmm. And so I did some things really well, and I did some things that I wouldn't have done in the second season. But we'll never know.
Yeah. What would you not have done in the second, or how do you think you would have changed?
I would have focused more probably on one sketch or two sketches. I would write five sketches a week, mm-hmm. you know, trying just to shotgun effect. Mm-hmm. And I would be more laser focused, and I would say, okay, I'm going to do this sketch and this character. I'm going to make it five pages of funny. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to work very specifically with these people and do things like that. And I would have had more confidence in my approach. Mm-hmm. And I would have had I wouldn't have been drinking out of the fire hose mm-hmm. so much. I would have been able to process things.
Are there any moments that stand out for you over that season, whether it's with certain hosts or musical guests or sort of what stands out?
Well, there was so many cool opportunities. I got to do scenes with Robert De Niro. I got to do scenes with my Will Ferrell, who's my comedy hero. I got to have really great conversations mm-hmm. with some of the most amazing people. U2 came and played, mm-hmm. And that's such a small, intimate space, yeah. you know. And then after the show ended, they played just for the audience, just for us, you know. Mm-hmm. I was there the night. My second show was the night Ashley Simpson walked off yeah. stage.
That's a big one.
She walked right by. I was standing next to Leo Allen, who's a wonderful mm-hmm. comedian, right, comic, and great, great writer.
Yeah, yeah.
And Leo, I think Leo had a drink in his hand, you know. For me, the show was over because it was the second song. There wasn't anything after that. After that, I was clean. So I'm just kind of standing there with Leo. And we're watching, watching like anything else. Yeah. And she did that little hoedown.
Yeah, you know, she starts dancing. Yeah. She was lip syncing.
And then she went off the stage.
Yeah.
And she came running by us. I mean, mm-hmm. like brushed shoulders with mm-hmm. me as she ran off. And I remember looking at Leo going, does she know this is live? Like, I panicked. I was like, I don't think she knows this is live. This is live. Did she know this is live? And he was like, dude, I've never seen anything like this. And I was like, oh my God, what just happened?
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was an unfortunate thing. I think it was the drummer had started playing the wrong song,
oh, yeah.
which set off a click track.
Oh.
And it started, yeah. there started the wrong song.
A lot of problems there.
But in all fairness, she got such a bad deal. Because I listened to her sing all week. Mm-hmm. She was awesome.
Yeah.
And then her voice, she got sick. Mm. And her voice gave way. And so at dress rehearsal, she's like, she could barely get it out. Yeah. And I was like, oh, my God. And so they're talking about canceling and mm-hmm. all this stuff. And so I understand why they had click tracks mm-hmm. and things like that. But it all got screwed up because it was last minute.
Yeah. And it's live. And it's live. Redo it.
Exactly. And so everybody pounced on her. And I thought, don't. You know, yeah. it's unfair. Mm-hmm. It's really unfair because she can sing. She, you know, mm-hmm. she did a fine job.
Yeah.
And she was gutting it out so that the show could go on.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just got mad. Everybody's just full of hate. It's sad.
Yeah. yeah. So how did you kind of find out that you weren't going to be coming back? And I know there's lots of stories about people sort of either not finding out until it's in the press or that kind of thing.
I definitely was the last to know. I was definitely the last to know because I didn't even realize it. I had just so sad. I remember I got a call from Amy Poehler the day before I found out. Mm-hmm. And she was like, Riggle. And I was like, what's up? And she goes, how's everything going? And I was like, it's awesome. I've been working out all summer, you know, losing weight. I've been working on some characters. And I think she was like, okay, ooh, he doesn't know.
Yeah.
And she goes, okay, cool. We're just checking in on you. Say hi. I was like, cool. You know, hey, all right. And then the next day, mm-hmm. I get a phone call from my agent mm-hmm. saying, yeah, they're not going to extend your contract. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, okay. And it still didn't even dawn on me. It was like a month later that I went, oh, Amy knew.
Yeah.
She knew before I did. That's why she was calling me.
Have you talked to her about that?
No, I don't want to embarrass her or anything, you know, but it became clear to me.
Yeah.
And then I remember I was at my parents' house, or they have a lake house. Mm-hmm. Down, and so I was at the lake house and I had my wife and my brand new baby daughter. And I had about a 15-minute pity party mm-hmm. where I felt really bad and yeah. really sad for myself. And, oh, God, and I was, you know, I was embarrassed and I was mm-hmm. all these things. And it really hurt. I'm not going to lie. It yeah. hurt and it burned and I was sad and crushed. And then I realized, as I had to go change my daughter's diaper, I was like, I'm still responsible for mm-hmm. providing for this family. Yeah. So I gotta suck it up mm-hmm. and find a new job.
Yeah.
And that's just it. And that was, I think, the first time I got a real taste of, oh, show business is cold. Mm-hmm. It's unforgiving. And it's, there's no guarantees.
Yeah.
You know, I was foolish enough to need, because it was my first job. I was like, SNL. Oh, cool. I do this for several mm-hmm. years and then I go do, you know, I can go do yeah. other things. Well, that's over. Now what are you going to
do? Starting from scratch.
Exactly. So all of a sudden I was like, oh my God, I gotta find a new job. And that's when I learned there's no finish line in show business. Mm-hmm. Never. There's yeah. never a time when you get to say, and I'm good.
Yeah.
I nailed it. I'm happy forever. It just doesn't exist. The best you can hope for is a long run on a good show.
Yeah.
Or several hit movies. Mm-hmm. But even that runs out after a while. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so hard. So I'm looking at Modern Family. Modern Family, those guys have been doing the show for 10 years. And it's yeah. one of the best shows on television. Mm-hmm. It's so enjoyable. But it's going to end.
Yeah.
And when it does, you know, the best they can hope for is to find another gig that is half as good.
Yeah.
It's very rare that lightning strikes twice, yeah. you know, so it's, showbiz is not, yeah. it's tough.
It's also very rare that people walk away, you know, some of these Modern Family people could probably walk away from working.
Oh, and go on to great things, yeah.
But I'm saying, and do something else or, you know, mm-hmm. but I think there's something about this business that makes people, you know, continually want to keep doing it for as long as they possibly can. Well,
yeah, I agree. I think acting...
Not for money necessarily, is my
yeah.
point.
Yeah, well, acting, it gets in your bones, it gets in your blood, you know, and then people start getting all weird and go, it's about the craft and the mm-hmm. art.
Yeah.
And listen, it is. Mm-hmm. you yeah. know, I mean, without being melodramatic or touchy-feely or squishy about it, it is. Mm-hmm. And you have to respect it. I do respect it. Mm-hmm. I remember there was a time when I had a very famous actor, you know, kind of jump me about it. Cause I was saying that. I was like, oh, I got to go do this thing. Mm-hmm. And he goes, don't devalue what we do. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, don't do that.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, oh, I just got my hand slapped. And he was right. Cause yeah. I was sitting there kind of making light of it or treating it like it was this thing that
a movie,
you know,
or a,
it was a movie. Yeah. yeah. And I was like, yeah, I need to honor this more and mm-hmm. be more professional about it and take it to heart. And so then I started doing that and it has made a difference.
Yeah. Also that thing of, if you had to do that movie 20 years earlier, you would have been thrilled probably.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. And so, I never want to be ungrateful.
Yeah.
Never ungrateful, because I know how hard it is. Mm-hmm. I know how hard it is to be a working actor or just to get an opportunity.
Yeah.
I know people out here who have been out here for 15 years who haven't even gotten an opportunity yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because they don't have talent. It's just because they, for whatever reason, they don't.
Yeah.
It's not the right look. It's the most subjective business in the world.
Totally.
You're never going to get past that.
Mm-hmm.
There's always going to be a producer or a director who doesn't like your face. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
They like that guy's face. That guy doesn't have the talent you do, mm-hmm. but that guy's face is, for mm-hmm. whatever reason, what the director envisioned.
Yeah.
Or what the producers want.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean they're pretty. It doesn't mean they're beautiful. It just means it's the face they wanted.
Yeah.
And you can't do anything about that.
Yeah.
You know? And so when you're dealing in a subjective business, it's really hard sometimes, because you know you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know you can do the work, and you know you can crush the role, and you know you can, but you're just not allowed
yeah.
to do it.
Yeah.
And you, all you can do is put your head down and go back to work. And if you don't have a thick skin, you shouldn't be in this business, because mm-hmm. they're going to beat the hell out of you.
Yeah.
Your emotions, your pride, your self-esteem, it's all going to take a lashing. That's just the way it is.
Coming up, Rob reveals how getting hired on The Daily Show may have literally saved his life. So the year after SNL,
yeah.
you got your next big audition for The Daily Show.
Yes.
And I think I know you've talked about how there was kind of even higher stakes for that one, because you were kind of debating whether you were going to
I was out of money.
Yeah.
I was completely out of money, and I was very seriously considering going back on active duty. We were in the middle of a war.
Mm-hmm.
They needed people.
This is 2006. A few years into the Iraq War.
Yeah, and it's full blown
at
this point. And I'm like, all I had to do was put my hand in the air and they'd mm-hmm. pick me up in a second mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. I'd go back on active duty. I was still a captain at the time. I could make good money. I could provide for my family. I could do all kinds of that, So I was like, all right, but we were out of money.
Yeah.
And so if I didn't get, and no one knows this, especially mm-hmm. the Daily Show. I'm not telling anybody. I'm not advertising this because
they don't want to hear that.
They don't want to hear it. And I don't want their pity.
Mm-hmm.
So, but my wife and I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, my back was against the wall. And if I hadn't gotten the Daily Show, about a week later, 2 weeks later, I probably would have had to go back and go back on active duty.
Yeah, that makes the audition process so much crazier than most people.
Yeah, the window, it takes pressure and then it puts pressure on top of pressure.
Yeah. So how did you handle that?
Deep breathing exercises and trying to relax. Bill Murray has a great quote about whatever you do in life, doesn't matter. Golf, sex, comedy, whatever it is you do in life, conversations,
mm-hmm.
you're always going to be better when you're relaxed. You do everything better relaxed.
Yeah.
So you got to get relaxed. So I was trying to relax under all that pressure, which is not easy to do. And I went in and gave it my best, just the old college try, if you will, gave it my best effort. And I thought I had screwed it up. I even called my wife and apologized, but I promised her. I said, "Hey, listen, this problem probably not going to go our way, but we're going to be fine. I don't want you to worry."
Yeah. This is reminiscent of the first stand-up performance, right?
Yeah, almost.
Maybe wasn't as bad as you thought it was.
Yeah, it wasn't as bad, but it wasn't my. I didn't feel like I had shown them mm-hmm. all my colors or shown them what I can really do. Because again, I was so nervous and tight, and I'm trying to relax, but you can only relax so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I called her and I said, "Listen, I don't know how this is going to go. I don't think it went well, but we're not going to starve. I promise. You and the baby are going to be fine. We're going to be okay. Don't worry. Everything's mm-hmm. going to be okay." And then they came in and told me I got the job, and that was a blessing. Mm-hmm. So it's good.
Rob, you're a member of the Marine Corps. You've been through the training the CIA director mentioned. Does the Marine Corps boot camp shock the conscience? It's a world of John. The things I've seen, they'd make Satan crap his pants. Really? No, I'm just screwing with you.
So how did that experience at The Daily Show kind of compare to your experience at SNL? Because they're very different shows and very different styles, but also cultures. I mean, how did you feel about it compared to being at SNL?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved it because what the 75 cast was to the baby boomers,
mm-hmm.
our cast was... in my opinion,
mm-hmm.
Or what the Daily Show, let me put it that way, the Daily Show was to the next generation.
Yeah, so Jon Stewart was hosting, and who else was there with you at that time?
John Oliver and I shared an office.
Mm-hmm.
Jason Jones, Sam B., Asif, Manvi, and I think Dan Bacadal was there for 1 year that I was there. And...
It's incredible these people who have been on that show, everyone was so great at the time, mm-hmm. and what you've all gone on to do is so amazing too.
Yeah.
Especially thinking about John Oliver and Samantha Bee and how they've kind of just taken what they did there to new heights.
Absolutely. They're amazing. And my time, John Oliver is the one who got me to go back and do stand up.
Oh yeah.
And I got him to go do improv.
I got him. Did?
Yeah, I got him to come down and do monologues for ASCAT. And then he's like, all right, now you got to come with me and do stand-up. And I was like, oh, God, don't make me do it. But he did. And then I ended up building, an hour-long set.
Yeah.
Just hanging out with him because I was a geographical bachelor, you know. Because mm-hmm. even though it was The Daily Show, they still pay you cable money.
Yeah.
We weren't getting paid anything. Mm-hmm. I was getting paid enough to send money home and keep a small studio.
You were commuting from L.A., is that right?
Yeah. Because I couldn't move. I couldn't afford to move everybody back east. It's weird how they do it. You know, you get 6 months probation mm-hmm. to see if they like you, and then you get another 6 months. So your first year is all kind of this half-year probation, and then they tell you, yeah, we're going to extend you, yeah, we're not. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't going to move everybody out until I knew. Well, then, and they still didn't pay us enough money, you know. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I was there for 3 years. And then finally I was just like, I got to go home. Mm-hmm. I've been away from my family too mm-hmm. long. And John Stewart was great. He was so gracious about that because he was like, I don't know how you stayed this long, dude. He goes, no problem. He goes, will you stay through the election? I said, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so I did.
That was the 08 election.
Yep. And I stayed through the election and we had great times. We went and covered the DNC and the RNC. Mm-hmm. We did great shows from the road. We just had a blast, and it was a great time, and I have no regrets. And I got to be Rob Riggle. You know, when you're on SNL, I was Toby Keith, I was Howard Dean, I was Leviticus, I was all these things, and people were like, "Who's this guy?
Nobody
who's this,
knows your name?
Yeah, who's this jerk?" Mm-hmm. But for 3 years, I got to be Rob Riggle. Mm-hmm. And
did you feel like you were able to bring, you know, yourself to the show in that way?
As best I could.
Was it your point of view that was being...
No, because you can play it for laughs. Mm-hmm. You know, it is, at the end of the day, a comedy show. Yeah. You know, I know everybody wanted to turn it into this political beacon, mm-hmm. but it's a comedy show at the end of the day, and we had to make comedy. Mm-hmm. I always just try to focus on that.
Yeah, it is interesting how Jon Stewart has kind of not fully walked away from comedy, but nearly fully. And, you know, every time we see him now, he's testifying on Capitol Hill for the, 9/11 first responders.
I was so proud of him when he did that. He did such a eloquent, he did that in a very articulate way.
Yeah.
And he did a wonderful job of advocating for those first responders, of which I was actually one of them.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I was down in the rubble piles I got my orders on September 11th because my reserve mm-hmm. unit was in Manhattan.
Yeah.
That's all.
So that was kind of the first first thing, because I know you deployed to Afghanistan not long after that, but you were actually, doing stuff in New York before then.
I was working on the rubble piles. I was in the bucket brigades.
Yeah.
Moving rubble by hand. But going back to John, you got to remember, John's been doing comedy his whole life. Mm-hmm. He's been doing stand-up his whole life, and that show was 45 weeks a year, and you got to feed the beast every day. Mm-hmm. You got to come up with it. And John was the clearinghouse. So he had writers, but he'd get out there and do a dress rehearsal, and we'd be like, we'd all go back into his office, and he'd put the script up on the wall, and people would go to work on it, And if you were in the show that day, you sat in there too, and and everybody's working on the words, and he did that every day, mm-hmm. every week. He was the captain of the ship, and he was responsible for everything. And I think he won an Emmy, 15 Emmys or something crazy?
Like that.
So it just shows you the unbelievably high standard mm-hmm. that he had, the work ethic that he had. Of course the man's burnt out. Mm-hmm. Of course he's tired. Of course he's fatigued. He needed a break, and I'm glad he's taking it. And I hope he's healing his soul, and I hope he's healing his mind, and he'll be back when he's ready.
Yeah, after I said nobody walks away from show business, he might be he could be an exception. But I hope he comes back and comes back to comedy as well.
Yeah.
So you made that decision to leave the show, and that must have been a little scary as well at that point, because you're going kind of back out into the wilderness, not knowing what would come next.
Absolutely. My family mattered more.
Yeah.
So I was happy. I was happy with the decision, mm-hmm. but it's also scary. I think people never want to give up what they have for something that's potentially out there. Mm-hmm. My advice to you is read a book called Who Moved My Cheese? Mm-hmm. And understand that change is never going to stop. Mm-hmm. You're always going to be changing. The better you get at it, the sooner you get good at change, the better your life's going to be. Mm-hmm. The people that resist change are going to have friction their whole life. Because they're trying to go against the grain.
Yeah.
things change. Mm-hmm. Things change.
So in terms of right now, I mean, you're turning 50 next year, I believe.
I don't think that's accurate.
Oh,
I think I'm turning 40. Oh. Something. I don't know. IMDb. Did you get that from Wikipedia? Because they like to lie.
Yeah, that's a lot of lies on there. So what are you, how are you, you know, feeling about this next stage of your career and what you kind of want to accomplish coming up?
Listen, I'll stay in front of the camera as long as someone will have me.
Mm-hmm.
I still love comedy. I still love acting. I'm going to do it again as long as somebody will have me. But I'm definitely getting into producing more. I've been producing a lot more shows. I produced, co-produced. I'm always producing with other people. Produced with Rob Riggle Ski Master Academy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm producing this Discovery show that I'm doing right now. I helped produce Shark Week. So, yes, I'm building my producer's side as well and my directing side as well, because if the day ever comes where they don't want me in front of the camera, then I'd like to just move behind it, because I still feel like I have a lot of insight, a lot of ideas. I've been on sets now for going on 15 years, so I've got a pretty good idea of how things should work, how things could work, and I've still got a lot to contribute to entertainment, I hope.
Yeah. So before we wrap up, what I want to do is a little bit of a speed round, going through some of the stuff that you, because you've done so many amazing things that we haven't talked about yet, and just to get kind of your, if there's one story or memory that kind of jumps out from that each thing.
Okay, I'll try.
So in 2006, I think this was between SNL and The Daily Show, you appeared on The Office.
Yes.
So what do you remember from that experience?
I remember being really happy because we were on a boat and we were sailed out of Long Beach, but we filmed on the boat. We had to be out on the water.
The whole shoot was on the boat. Yeah.
So nobody got to go back to their dressing rooms. Like in between shots while they were doing resets and stuff, we all just sat in the booths and talked and hung out.
Yeah.
So I was sitting there talking with John Krasinski and Amy Adams and, you know, all these amazing people that I just
She was a guest star on that episode too,
And I just remember thinking so highly of all these actors and then having time to just sit and talk to them. Because normally people go to Crafty, people go to their dressing rooms, people kind of break away. But when you're on a boat, you know, a little cruise, a dinner cruise boat like that, there's nowhere to go.
Yeah.
And so we all just sat there and talked. So I was very lucky in that sense. I remember enjoying, like, oh, this is cool.
On The Daily Show, you went to Iraq to film for The Daily Show. So what stands out from that experience for you?
That was truly amazing. It was at the actual height of the violence in the war in Iraq. It was the summer of 2007. And what I loved was we filed reports from Iraq, but we entertained the troops everywhere we went.
Yeah.
And I took Rob Hubel, Paul Scheer, Horatio Sands. I took all my buddies.
Going back to the original UCB days.
I went back to all my UCB buddies and I said, I'm going to go do this thing. Will you come with? And we'll entertain the troops. And, you know, and this is the height of the violence. I mean, there was many a time in the middle of a show, you know, the machine gun, the 60 would go off and we'd have to scramble to the bunkers.
Wow.
And
you were probably more used to that type of thing than those guys were.
Yeah, probably a little bit.
hopefully they felt safe with you.
Yeah, I think they did. But we were, you know, it's so funny too, is like we went to a new base every night. Every day we'd get up, get on helicopters and fly to the next. And they were all FOBs, all forward operating bases. Yeah. So they're out there on the pointy end of the spear.
Yeah.
And we'd land, we'd spend all day with the troops. I would try to squeeze in a quick story about something, and then we'd do a show that night because it was 125 degrees at night and like 137 during the day, and you know it was just unbearable. So we would do these shows. Well, maybe it was 125 during the day and like 118 or 17 at night. But we'd have to wait till nighttime to do the shows. And but it was so much fun to entertain the troops. It meant a lot. I don't know. It's special, I think. And it's one of those really cool memories, that something we all went through together. But everywhere we landed, they always put us in these, you know, we'd have bunk beds or whatever. And we were like boys at camp. We'd stay up all night talking and telling jokes and making fun of each other. And we're like, guys, we need to get to sleep. It's like 3 a.m. We're flying out of here in 2 hours. You know, shut up. We're going to be up all day, you know, tomorrow. And we got another show. and we couldn't help ourselves.
Yeah, those were some funny guys, so I can imagine the late nights. So you mentioned Will Ferrell was someone you know you looked up to at SNL, and then in Step Brothers you got to kind of improvise with him and also Adam McKay directing. So what was that experience like for you?
That was one of the greatest experiences of all time. Mm-hmm. You know, people ask me all the time, "What was your favorite movie to make?" And to make Step Brothers, because Adam and Will are such great improvisers. And Adam appreciates it. He lets you run amok. Mm-hmm. If you look at the deleted scenes on the DVD, you'll see what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
There's some really funny stuff on there that no one will ever see. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, playing with Will, he's so gracious. You know, if he's the straight man, he'll be the straight man. If mm-hmm. he's the crazy one, he'll be the crazy one. Mm-hmm. It just, he doesn't care, just as long as the comedy is working.
Yeah.
And so he's such a great straight man. Because my character was over the top.
Yeah.
And so he was kind of always forced into that straight man role whenever we shared a scene. But we improvised well. Adam Scott got into it, you mm-hmm. know, and it was all fun. Because people ask that all the time. They're like, you know, that whole Kobayashi line, or Randy here is going to eat your dick.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the improv rule, yes and, right? Mm-hmm. Yes means agreement. I'm going to agree with what was said. And means I'm going to add information. Well, when he says, Randy here is going to eat your dick, if I said, no, I won't, scene's over, right?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, it gets awkward and weird, and the scene doesn't work. So I have to say yes without saying yes. So I said, like Kobayashi, and I start chowing down on a hot dog. Well, that made it in, because that's yes and. That's mm-hmm. improv, mm-hmm. and that's how things work.
Hey, your brother wants a shot of the Catalina wine mixer.
I'm ready. I'm walking tall.
You think you're ready to run with the bulls?
I've been earning and burning, snapping necks and cashing checks.
Screw it. Let's let him do it. No, it's a win-win for me. Because if you fuck up, Brennan, if you fuck up, I get to fire your ass. But if you pull it off, I look like a genius to the board. Okay?
I get it.
Look, Brennan, here's the thing. It's the Catalina fucking wine mixer. Okay?
Are you saying pow? What are you saying?
It's the biggest helicopter leasing event in the Western Hemisphere since 1997.
Why does he keep doing that?
I have to sell or lease at least 80 choppers to make my nut. And you mess with my nut, Brennan? Randy here is going to eat your dick.
Like Kobayashi.
I've seen him do it.
And so we had fun, you mm-hmm. know, and we would say things to each other. Like, I didn't know he was going to say that. I didn't know he was going to say, Randy here is going to eat your dick.
Yeah.
But you have to make something out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I had a ton of fun. That was an amazing movie.
Yeah. So The Hangover is something that I think a lot of people know you from, even though you're only in what, one or two scenes in the movie. Or?
Yeah, I think two scenes. The tasering scene, mm-hmm. and then when I kick in the door to get the baby arrest them all.
Yeah, I was curious if you got to interact with or work at all with Brody Stevens in that movie.
Absolutely.
And what you remember from that?
I remember Brody he's just a pistol. He's shot out of a cannon, mm-hmm. you know. And I used to run into Brody like when I would go do At Midnight, because he used to warm up the crowd there. And Brody and I went to a couple of Dodger games together. Mm-hmm. He was a wonderful baseball player and a big baseball fan. He knew every stat, every player, you know, when you're around Brody, it's Brody's world, which was fun because he had such a big personality.
Mm-hmm.
I was very sad. I went to his tribute down at the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
I was very sad that he passed, because I think he had a lot to offer.
Yeah. So I had Jeff Ross on the show not too long ago, and we talked about the roast of Rob Lowe a decent amount, and I know you were part of that as well. What stands out for you from that night?
Oh, big lesson. If you're ever going to get roasted, make sure there's somebody else on the dais that will draw a lot of heat. And he brought Ann Coulter, which she drew a lot of heat off of him, off of Rob, so I thought that was very clever. But I remember having fun. I remember hanging out with Peyton Manning, and Peyton is a very funny guy. He gets it. He knows why things are funny. He's just a funny dude. And like Ralph Macchio was very super sweet. He's just mm-hmm. a sweet man, you know, very nice. And I was sitting next to Pete Davidson the whole night, and he was hilarious. He was just a pistol.
Yeah, and that's so kind of before most people knew who he was, probably, right?
Well, I think people were starting to know. Yeah. He definitely hadn't dated anybody.
He wasn't as famous as he is now.
Yeah, he wasn't dating. His dating prowess wasn't quite there yet. But anyway, I enjoyed everybody. I really did. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, getting to bust on Rob, because Rob and I did a pilot together. Mm-hmm. And it was so much fun, and we hit it off. And so I was really honored that he asked me to be there.
Yeah. So the final thing that we do on the show is I'm going to ask you what the last thing that made you laugh really hard is. What comes to mind? It could be something on TV or in a movie or in a stand-up show or just anything that made you laugh.
Okay, so it was at a charity event, my charity event in Kansas City, and I'm going to screw up his last name, and I apologize in advance. Nate
Bergazzi.
I always say, when I say Bergetsky, I always screw it up. So Bergazzi?
I think it's Bergazzi.
Bergazzi. Yeah. Well, Nate, mm-hmm. as I know him,
yeah.
just destroyed it.
Yeah.
He is the funniest guy. I think he is hilarious, and he had me doubled over laughing, like yeah. genuinely laughing. And he's not doing anything crazy. He's just a wonderful storyteller and a wonderful, has such a wonderful demeanor yeah. about his stories. I don't know. The last time I laughed out hard, a genuine laugh, it was with him for sure.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming and doing this. It was really fun.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you again to Rob Riggle for being my guest on today's show. If you want to hear more from Nate Bergazzi, who he mentioned as his favorite comic right now, definitely check out the episode I did with him on this podcast from a couple of weeks ago. You can catch Holy Moly Thursday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern on ABC, and Riggle's Shark Week special on the Discovery Channel is coming this Sunday night, July 28th at 9 p.m. If you enjoy this show, please tell your friends, share this episode, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude. You can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find the show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.